What can a type of cactus tell us about cancer and treating the disease? Two researchers at ASU believe a lot. Carlo Maley and Athena Actipis have helped set up a cactus garden on the school's Tempe campus, but the garden doesn't feature the kinds of specimens you might expect to see. Instead, they're plants with kinds of malformations on them. Maley is an associate professor in ASU's School of Life Sciences and director of the Arizona Cancer Evolution Center. Actipis is an assistant professor in the psychology department and director of ASU's Interdisciplinary Cooperation Initiative. The pair is interested in something called adaptive therapy, which is in the early stages of research, although they'll be opening a clinical trial with the Mayo Clinic for patients with late-stage breast cancer. One of their ideas is to look at what a tumor is doing and only treat it if it's growing. I recently met Carlo Maley and Athena Actipis at their cactus garden and asked Actipis to describe it.
Well, so here we have a garden that features some really amazing cacti. They're called crested cacti, and they have what are called faciations. And faciations are basically the plant way of saying cancer or something like cancer. It's when you get a mutation or some other disruption to the growth pattern. And so you get interesting forms. In saguaro cacti, they look like these giant crowns that are, you know, on top of the cacti.
So what causes these kind of malformations?
Well, there is still some uncertainty about exactly what causes them. Some of them are caused by viruses or bacteria. Some of them are caused by injury and regrowth. And others are apparently caused by mutations that occur during development. And the point of sort of bringing these cacti here to this garden where people could see them and see them in relation to these questions about cancer is that they make it clear that cancer isn't something that just humans struggle with.
Well, so what do these cacti tell us about something we might be able to apply to cancer in people?
They tell you that you don't have to die from cancer. One of the things we want to illustrate with this garden is that it's possible to live with cancer. And that's reflective of a shift which we're exploring in the way we do cancer therapy now, which is to tame it, essentially, to cultivate it in some ways, to prevent it from killing us, but to live with it rather than die from it. So we've found that if we go in very aggressively and treat with the highest dose chemotherapy we can, it's a very effective way for killing a lot of cancer cells, but it's also an effective way for selecting for mutants that are resistant to our drugs. And so we're shifting the way we do cancer therapy, actually from lessons from agriculture about how farmers control pests in their field and control pesticide resistance in their field.
Are there biological differences, though, between people and plants that maybe make the theory of living with cancer as opposed to just trying to get it as quickly as you can challenging?
Certainly. So for a long time, people thought that plants did not get cancer because of these major biological differences. They don't have organs, so like a critical organ system that if it fails in us, we die, right? So they can sustain some damage or abnormality without dying. Although these crestings do make it more likely that the cactus will be blown over and also interfere with it flowering and reproducing. So it's important for the evolution. It interferes with the evolution of that lineage. But in an animal or a human, we will have to intervene to prevent cancer from killing us, whereas it's more of a natural phenomenon in plants that doesn't usually kill them.
One of the biggest concerns about cancer is its spread, and it starts someplace and metastasizes and goes elsewhere where you don't want it to go. By trying to live with it as opposed to eradicate it, how do you try to make sure that if you have a tumor, presumably for some period of time that you're living with, how do you try to monitor it and make sure that it's staying where it is and staying the size it is and not expanding elsewhere?
Well, that's actually one of the large logistical problems that we'll have to deal with when we translate how we're doing pest control to cancer control. That is, we need some effective and not very expensive way of monitoring the total tumor burden, the total across the whole patient's body. It's something that we can do in some cases, like in prostate cancer, there's blood tests, and we're trying to develop other tests to be able to monitor it.
Sometimes treating with really aggressive therapy can lead not just to the evolution of resistance to the drug, but there's some evidence that it can actually spur on invasion and metastasis. And the mechanisms underlying that aren't completely understood, but it does suggest that potentially scaling back on the intensity of therapy might possibly be a way to reduce the likelihood of metastasis invasion. So, you know, you're sort of making a trade-off where you're, in a way, letting the cancer, you know, stick around, but trying to keep it under control rather than trying to hit it with a really high dose and then risking that it'll evolve to be resistant or actually evolve to colonize other tissues.
This seems like it would be a pretty radical shift in thinking, both for oncologists, for physicians, but also for patients who, you know, when you get that diagnosis, you want it out of you as quickly as possible. You don't want to think about, this is something that I could be living with for the rest of my life.
Yeah, indeed. That's, I think, one of the interesting challenges, but also really important opportunities, because I think historically cancer has been seen as this thing that is very scary, very foreign. It's, you know, the enemy that needs to be eradicated. But this new way of looking at cancer, it helps us to see, well, actually, cancer is a part of life. It's a part of non-human animals. It's a part of plants. And we've evolved to kind of keep it under control so that it doesn't kill us too early, so that we can still successfully reproduce. It's part of the sort of, in a way, the trade-off of being multicellular, is that you have this massive cooperation among, you know, 30 trillion cells that are working together basically to get your genes to the next generation. But just like with any large-scale cooperative venture, there's a possibility that some individuals will exploit it. And that's basically what cancer is.
There's, I think, other things to say about the experience of having cancer. I agree with you, the initial response is, get it out of me. I want to go back to that life I had before I had this disease. But anybody who's actually struggled with that or had a loved one that struggled with it knows that you can't actually ever go back. So I was diagnosed with melanoma when I was 32. It was early stage. I think I'm cured of it. But from now on, for the rest of my life, I won't know. And if I have some strange physical problem, it's always going to be haunted with, is that the cancer that's come back? Has it metastasized? And so you can't go back to that life you had before.
Well, that kind of raises the question of how what you guys are doing fits into what other researchers are doing in terms of trying to find cures for at least particular kinds of cancers, or maybe even a vaccine to prevent people from getting certain types of cancers. Where does this fit into that, do you guys think?
There's a lot of answers to that question. We study the evolution of cells in the body in that process of getting cancer with a goal of preventing it. And one way of doing that is not just to cut it out, which we do when we can, but to slow down that process. And so we think about how to slow that evolutionary process. But there are collaborators of ours and other people in our community that are also trying to find ways of living with cancer.
So do you think that this type of therapy might be better suited to certain types of cancer or certain types of patients, whereas some of the other types of treatments that exist already might be better suited for others?
Certainly. If a tumor is not very genetically diverse, if all the cells in the tumor are very similar to each other, there's a much higher chance of you actually getting a cure. Whereas if it's very diverse, then there's a high chance that some of the cells in there will have mutations that make them resistant to the drug of whatever drug you're choosing. So we think there's differences between patients at that level. But one thing that's very exciting about it is the whole strategy is not specific to a type of cancer. So it should be widely generalizable, applied to many cancers, and in fact, many drugs.
Maybe I'll just add one thing about, I think, the psychological shift from this idea of, you know, a war on cancer aimed at eradication to something different. And I'm really struck by how there are many, many different war strategies out there, right? And in The Art of War, Sun Tzu talks about the importance of taking your enemy's perspective, right? So rather than just going with full force, you stop, you consider your enemy's perspective, you consider your goals, and you only have a sort of escalated conflict if you know you can decisively win. Because if you can't decisively win, then it can end up having huge costs. And so I think, you know, part of what we need to do is change the way that we're thinking about approaching cancer. And even if we want to keep this language of the war on cancer, we need to think differently about what kind of war it is. You know, it shouldn't be a war of sort of all-out military destruction.
Scorched earth.
Yeah, not a scorched earth kind of war, but rather a very sort of considered, strategic, intelligence-driven war where we don't try to destroy the sort of enemy of cancer at the expense of destroying the patient.
And actually, I do want to talk about the sort of underlying idea here, and it sort of gets back to the art of war with your enemy's enemy is your friend, right? And it turns out that having a mutation that makes a pest resistant to pesticide or a cancer cell resistant to a chemotherapy, that mutation, that resistance has a cost. And so in the absence of the pesticide, or in the absence of the chemotherapy, the sensitive pests and the sensitive cancer cells actually can do better than the resistant ones. They can outcompete the resistant cells. And so the idea, the underlying idea behind adaptive therapy is you need to keep some of those sensitive cells around because they can outcompete the resistant cells. Now, the clinician can't do anything about resistant cells. They're the things we can't control. And what we do with high-dose therapy is we kill all the sensitive cells. There's nothing left to compete with the resistant cells. It grows back and kills the patient, right? So what we wanted to do is actually keep the sensitive cells around to outcompete the resistant cells and keep them under control. And that leads you down this path of we're going to keep this tumor around for the rest of your life. But it's not going to kill you, and you can live with it, and we can manage it just like we do with diabetes. In the future, we think that it's likely that we won't cure cancer so often, but we will manage it so that nobody's dying of cancer.
Yeah, or maybe we'll even just rethink what it means to cure cancer. And you know, maybe seeing a tumor that's stable for 6 months without additional treatment will be considered a cure.
And in the future, we'll probably just be monitoring it at some regular intervals, and we'll probably have a better understanding of how often we have to monitor it, how likely is it to start growing again, and it'll be just a normal part of our healthcare that we keep these things under control and monitored and keep us safe so that we can live out our natural lives.
Carlo Maley is an associate professor in ASU's School of Life Sciences and director of the Arizona Cancer Evolution Center. Athena Aktipis is an assistant professor in ASU's Psychology Department and director of the Interdisciplinary Cooperation Initiative.